Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up, we've got live music from the indie rockers known as St. Rich, and a look at one of music's most maligned yet still popular styles. Remember smooth jazz?
Smooth jazz. CD 101.9.
Where listening during your 9 to 5 can mean a vacation away from work. Paradise.
From New York's chill out station, smooth jazz.
Personally, I always thought that if you could listen to any music at work, it was like a mini vacation, but whatever. Chilling out is nice. So is not chilling out and getting all excited and even argumentative about music, though really, how can you do that listening to George Benson? But Beatles and Stones fans? Well, they've been doing it for 50 years. Since 1964, when both bands had their first American hits and made their U.S. TV debuts. And all the recent Beatles nostalgia has reignited the old debate between fans of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Okay, maybe we reignited it. And in the lead-up to our Beatles vs. Stones Soundcheck Smackdown at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts on Thursday evening, we've asked our listeners to pick a side. You can make your case at soundcheck.org or at 866-939-1612. David on our Facebook page wrote this: as far as pushing boundaries, the Beatles were more groundbreaking. They produced perfect albums, and I am a huge fan. If I had to pick, I would go Stones every time.
Hey, think the time is right for Palace Revolution.
I suspect our first guest would too. Bill Janovitz is a music writer and founding member of the band Buffalo Tom. He wrote 50 essays for a recent book called Rocks Off, 50 Tracks That Tell the Story of the Rolling Stones. He joins us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. At what point did you say to yourself in this project, my God, what have I done?
Well, when the idea was at first brought to me, hey, do you want to write another book about the Rolling Stones? Because I wrote one on the subject of Exile on Main Street for the 33 and a Third series.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't want to write another one, basically. I mean, first of all, the story's been told a million times before, but then it was presented to me. It was like, well, what about if you're doing 50 tracks for the 50 years? And I said, well, that's an interesting hook, and I really would like to write about the music. I'm not really interested in writing yet another history, but this is a nice way to kind of hang the history and how, in the context of the music and vice versa. Like, how does one affect the other? How does one reflect the other?
Right. And so each of these songs, the essays aren't so much about, you know, what happens to the chord progression the second time around as it is what were the guys doing at this point in their lives and careers.
It's a little bit of both, actually. I mean, I didn't want to geek out too much being a musician that spent 25 years in the studio, 26 years in the studio, but I did want to share a little bit of what that experience is like, you know, to be in the studio. And, you know, oftentimes we're, the producers and the musicians are just kind of riffing about how bands like the Stones and the Beatles or whoever else got these classic sounds. And I do kind of spend a lot of time talking about the music and what makes this a great song. But I also do kind of get into what was going on in their lives and how these tracks might tell the story.
So let's take an example, the Stray Cat Blues. Now, you divide the book into three eras for the three guitarists other than Keith Richards: Brian Jones era, Mick Taylor era, and the Ron Wood era. So Brian Jones first. Stray Cat Blues, you call this catnip for those folks in 1968 who were outraged about the group's attitude towards women.
Yeah, I mean, they really doubled it down on this record. I mean, you know, they had kind of come out of that blues sort of macho poser thing that they were going through and become pop stars, you know, with Satisfaction onward.
Get no.
then they kind of went into a little bit into the hippie-dom stuff with, you know, they got a little fey with, you know, Satanic Majesties is a great record that's sort of underrated, but they kind of went off into different directions of psychedelia and other influences.
Turning around.
Then they had the famous 1967 busts. They took the first year off the road that they had taken since they started. And they really looked like they could have been down and out for the count right there. But they came roaring back with First Jumping Jack Flash as a single.
Watch it!
And then the really kind of seedy and dark and kind of... I guess what Grail Marcus would call the old weird America type of record with Beggar's Banquet, which has a lot of Appalachian, a lot of blues.
Waiting for a girl who's got curls in her hair. Waiting for a girl, she's no money anywhere. We get busted everywhere. Waiting for a factory girl.
And you know what they did is they sort of doubled down on the sort of blues history that they came from, but really kind of brought it to a contemporary context, so that you hear literally the Velvet Underground's influence on this song.
Right.
You can hear the opening kind of cadence of Heroin, the Velvet Underground song.
Yeah. And Brian Jones' influence, not in the guitar parts here, right?
Yeah, no, Brian on this track, I think, primarily comes through with a weird kind of mellotron part at the end. So you do have a little bit of that psychedelia floating through the kind of fluty sounds near the end as it dissipates into this kind of even weird, odd kind of seediness at the end.
Let's hear a little bit of the song that Bill Janovitz is talking about, one of the 50 songs he talks about in his new book, Rocks Off, Telling the Story of the Rolling Stones. The song is Stray Cat Blues from the Rolling Stones' 1968 record Beggar's Banquet, one of the 50 tracks that Bill Janovitz chose to write about in the book Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. So what does this song tell us about the story of the Stones?
It really tells us that they're getting back to their roots, but also kind of keeping it up to date. You know, that I think they found a contemporary home for the blues that wasn't just some sort of period piece. Like, it was a way of forwarding the message of what was going on then. And it's kind of, it speaks a little bit of urban decay. I mean, clearly it's sort of a pimp-esque. I always heard that song as a rock star talking to a groupie, and I think that certainly is in it. And they're playing up that big bad wolf routine, but I think it's got a little bit of that sort of pre-Taxi Driver type of look at a pimp's relationship with a young hooker.
You know, I mean, I've heard that song so many times. I still don't know what he's saying for most of it. You know, that's why the idea that people would listen to this song in 1968 and immediately be outraged is like, really? How do you know what he's saying?
I don't think they were, because I think it was kind of buried in the album. You know, not even casual Stones fans really know much about this. I mean, it's on Get Your Ya-Ya's Out as a live version too, which is even kind of more rock and roll. But I mean, it's pretty. It's definitely a come on. I can hear you. He says, I know you're just 16 years old, and you know I don't want your ID. And it's
Well, of course, you know, there's, as you mentioned in the book, there are many, many songs about 16-year-old girls that predate the Rolling Stones.
I think I said how many rock and roll songs from the 50s are not about teenage girls.
Really. So, Bill, how did you choose the 50 songs?
Well, you know, I really wanted to, you know, obviously get a lot of my favorites in there, if not all of them. And I couldn't get all of them. For example, on Goat's Head Soup, Angie is not one of my favorite songs anymore. Mm-hmm. It might have been when I was a kid. But, I mean, I would have gladly have included a song like Winter, which is kind of an unheralded, it's sort of a Stones fan's Stones song. It's a beautiful song, but it doesn't really forward the narrative very much as much as Angie does. Primarily, Angie was about them staying relevant and to the extent that they had another worldwide hit after being sort of written off yet again, and where Keith was really slipping into bad drug use by his own admission.
Angie, Angie, when will those clouds all disappear? Angie, Angie, where will it lead us from here?
You know, so here it was, kind of them reclaiming the top of the charts again. So, you know, and then I really wanted to pay attention all the way throughout the whole career. I mean, here's a band that part of the main part of the Stone story is that they really were survivors and kept putting out new music, you know, right into, the early 2000s. So I really wanted to give every record its due. So there's at least one song from every album.
All right. So we're speaking with Bill Janovitz, author of this new book called Rocks Off, also a member of the band Buffalo Tom, with us on Soundcheck. And actually coming to play, you're doing some shows as Bill Janovitz, not as Buffalo Tom, right, here in New York.
That's right.
Friday at Spike Hill in Brooklyn, Saturday at Rockwood Music Hall, Stage 3, and then Sunday, a Stones review at the LIC Bar in LIC, Long Island City in Queens.
That's right. Yeah, a bunch of people playing Stones songs.
So you mentioned that your first Stones book was for that 33 and a Third series, which is like, for people who haven't seen it, they're small paperback books about a single record, and you did Exile on Main Street. And the song we're going to hear next is the one that, it comes from Exile, and it's the one that gives you the title of this new book, Rocks Off. What is it about this song that stood out for you?
Well, this is kind of the classic great opening track from an album, and it really kind of tells the story, or at least a big part of the story, of Exile on Main Street, which is really divided up into, you know, the double record divided up into four sides, and they're not really balanced. I mean, each side is, you know, like the first side one is just all balls to the wall rock and roll, you know,
right.
And it starts off with this track, and it's the classic opening salvo, and it's got all the things that you think of as being great early 70s. It's got that groove. It's got those chugging rhythm guitars. It's got a horn part. And it's Mick really singing with the sort of conviction that he sort of eventually kind of lost, I think, as they waded into the 80s.
So, and this is from the second of the three eras. Brian Jones is dead by this point. Mick Taylor is the second guitarist in the Rolling Stones. Let's hear Rocks Off from Exile on Main Street. Rocks Off from the Rolling Stones album Exile on Main Street, two record set that they released in 1972, and one of the 50 tracks in Bill Janovitz's new book called Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. So what is this song and Exile on Main Street in general, what does this tell us about the story of the Stones?
Well, this is an interesting. I mean, you know, they've struggled with Exile over the years. I mean, Mick is all about the present or the future. Keith, you know, some people say this is Keith's record. Some people say that's. I mean, clearly, Tattoo U is Mick's record. He saved the band yet another time, putting that one together from old outtakes. But coming back a little bit further, close to this one in time, Goat's Head Soup was more of Mick's record. I think he was kind of the driving force with a lot of ballads there and. Some funk influence there. But this is really, I mean, Exile on Main Street is, I said in the Exile book, it's kind of the perfect distillation of all the essential components of roots and rock and country music. You know, what made rock and roll great to begin with up to the 1970s? You know, it's kind of a little bit of a punk rock record as well. I mean, you could hear that Mick was very conscious of the Stooges and Velvets. And I mean, that stuff was all there. A little bit of glam rock maybe even, but it's kind of a retro record. But it still feels very much new, and it really kind of... You know, with Tumbling Dice and songs like that, Let It Loose, the gospel influence. I mean, it's just it's sort of the last real big sort of bluesy gospel record that they did, you know.
So that's the second of the three eras. There's the Brian Jones era first, Mick Taylor second, and then Mick Taylor leaves the band and is replaced by Ron Wood, and that is the era of the Rolling Stones that you admit, I think it's at the beginning of the book, to having the most difficult time with. I mean, you wanted to represent it, but let's face it, some of the records were, well, you damn them with faint praise.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say that it's the Ron Wood years, just the Ron Wood years, because I mean, I think Ron Wood, he's sort of an underrated figure in the Stones history, and I mean, he really comes out of the Faces. He was you know, kind of like family to the Stones, and he really kind of gave them a kick in the ass. He came in at the tail end of Black and Blue, but you know, the next record was Some Girls, and
right, which
that's
was
them
a,
really,
yeah, a return to form for the band.
Absolutely, yeah, and he's really one of the driving forces on that. And then they had personal difficulties, and they couldn't pull another record together, so they went back to the outtakes and put together Tattoo U. And then after Tattoo U, you know, arguably, you know, they had definitely found, I think, their last peak, and it was a matter of scraping it together and trying to stay current all the time. Was Mick seemed to be Mick. You know, forced, right? Trying to keep them commercially relevant. And, you know, so I do feel like they found their footing on some later records as well. But, you know, to me, the 80s records in particular, like Undercover and that kind of stuff. And I know there's some diehards that love that stuff. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to love some of that stuff.
In talking about our next song, Out of Tears, from the 1993 record Voodoo Lounge, you say, the Stones continued to come up with some genuinely good songs.
Yeah, and, you know...
I mean, that's not the most enthusiastic imprimatur I've ever read, Bill, but... all right, so how good is this song?
Well, this is a really good song. I mean, you know, it's kind of... It really could have been on some of their early, mid-70s records. It's definitely a kind of plaintive ballad, and it's Mick just kind of picking out the notes on the piano. That's how it was written. But this one's got this. I think it's the first one with Daryl Jones on bass, or in the book, maybe. So it's a different era for this. And then Chuck Lavelle, who had been with the Allman Brothers, is now a keyboard player for them. And I think even Benmont Tench from the Heartbreakers is Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers is playing a little organ on this track.
Out of Tears is the name of the song from the Rolling Stones' Voodoo Lounge.
I can't feel a thing. I can't shout, I can't scream, breathe it out, breathe it in, all this love from within.
From the album Voodoo Lounge, 1993 record from the Rolling Stones, that is Out of Tears, one of 50 tracks that Bill Janovitz chose to write about in his new book, Rocks Off, 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. And so what part of the story are we getting here?
Well, now I think it's the Stones just sort of wrestling with their legacy, and I think coming to terms with it ultimately. You know, for all the interviews that Mick gave, saying sort of, you know, we're done with the past. Let's try to sound something, you know, bring something new. What's the point, essentially? And it's a valid point. I think that you also have to say, well, look, I mean, you know, here's all this great history you've built. Here's this sound you guys built. You kind of stay within your wheelhouse to some extent. And to hear Daryl Jones bringing, I mean, even having been in a band all these years since I'm whatever 12 years old. I don't know if I ever gave the bass player that much of a credit because, you know, it's just a different sound. Daryl plays differently than Bill
than
would.
Bill Wyman,
Bill Wyman would probably play the notes a little bit more staccato maybe, or I don't know. There was a bit more of a swing. He's an older school. But Daryl comes in with sort of a beefier sort of almost steady low end. And it's just a little different. I mean, I think it brings a different flavor to the Stones.
As your book does, to the oft-told tale of the Stones. Instead of giving us more chapter and verse history of Mick and Keith and the gang, Bill Janovitz gives us 50 tracks that tell the story of the Rolling Stones. The book is called Rocks Off. Bill's here in town performing Friday night at Spike Hill in Brooklyn, Saturday at the Rockwood Music Hall on Stage 3, and Sunday a Stones review with friends at the LIC Bar in Long Island City. Bill, it's been great going through some of these 50 tracks with you today. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Here's another Soundcheck listener picking a side in our Beatles versus Stones Smackdown.
Definitely the Beatles, best band in the world. It wasn't just about the music, but it was about what they did. They changed the world. They gave us a new way of thinking, the themes of love and peace. And their influence is just, there's nothing like it. Go Beatles. My name is Sylvina, and I'm calling in New York City.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, but you can learn how to play the game.
St. Rich is a new project that was spawned from another indie rock band called Delicate Steve. We'll hear St. Rich perform in our studio next. And later, everything you ever wanted to know about smooth jazz, but were too embarrassed to ask. This is Soundcheck.
I'm walking down the city street. I feel like some strange priest. I give the children all my money.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Although the band St. Rich just put out their debut album last fall, their story actually stretches back farther than that. The group is led by Christian Peslak and Steve Marion, who formed St. Rich almost by accident during a rehearsal for their other instrumental band called Delicate Steve. We'll talk with the New Jersey natives in a minute, but first, the group's going to play for us. The album is called Beyond the Drome, and this song is called Sorry Sadly. Here is St. Rich, live on Soundcheck.
From which you spark. Oh, yeah, I could get into your eyes. When you cry, will be too much.
The band is called St. Rich, performing live on Soundcheck. That's a song from their full-length debut, which is called Beyond the Drone, and which is out now. St. Rich is Christian Peslak, singing and playing guitar. Steve Marion also playing guitar. Shane O'Connell on bass, Marshall Garbus on keyboards and more guitar, Michael Duncan behind our drum kit. Christian and Steve joining me at the microphones. Guys, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello, welcome.
Us. So you guys have another band, Delicate Steve.
Yes. Right.
In which presumably, Christian, it's an instrumental band, you don't sing.
I don't sing. I sing a little bit, but not right. real words.
Okay. So yeah. It's voice as instrument sort of thing.
Vocables, yeah.
So this is a big step. I mean, it might seem like, well, there's two guys playing guitar together, and then they add words, and boom, they have another band.
Right.
But it changes the songwriting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I was kind of writing songs like this before Delicate Steve, you know, so it doesn't feel like anything too crazy.
Yeah. Chris has always been a rock star, and Delicate
right,
Steve
right.
was holding him back.
Uh-huh.
So it's not news to anybody from New Jersey.
Where in New Jersey?
Sussex County.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Was there any kind of, what kind of music scene was there when you guys were in school? You were in high school together, right, the whole
no,
time?
No, we would have never been in high school together because we're 5 years apart, I think.
I think five years, yeah.
So, but there was a music scene that centered around some church shows, local shows. So we all knew each other, and I would say everyone probably likes to think their scene was pretty vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd probably say the same about ours.
So when you started playing together, it was as an instrumental band then?
Originally, you're
yeah.
saying. No, I mean, we've been playing music for a long time, so Delicate Steve was just something that manifested one day, like this project.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I remember calling Christian and saying, I think I'm going to make an album. And then that went on to tour the world for the past 3 years. So they're all side projects in a way. It's not like...
So what's the main... If they're all side projects, what's the main thing?
We paint. We like to paint.
Yeah.
Really?
Painting and drawing.
So do you do your own artwork, album art, and all that kind of stuff?
Christian does. Christian does a lot of it.
And you guys have recently released a collaborative EP with Dr. Dog.
Yes.
Yeah. And you guys are touring with Dr.
Yeah,
Dog.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that mean, a collaborative EP? I mean, do the two bands come together? Do you work on each other's songs?
We worked on each other's songs collaboratively through mostly email exchange. They covered one of our songs, and all of that band now lives in different states.
Mm.
They were originally from Philadelphia, all from Philly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And now one of them, Scott, lives in Connecticut, and another one lives in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
So they put their cover of a St. Rich song together through email, and Christian and I did ours together just with an old tape recorder.
Hmm. Well, folks, you can find a download link for this collaborative EP, the two bands, St. Rich and Dr. Dog, on our website at soundcheck.org. The album called Beyond the Drone is out now, and St. Rich is touring around. And then once that's done, you guys will be playing again as Delicate Steve here in New York.
Yes.
Right.
On April 2nd at Le Poisson Rouge. St. Rich here with us on Soundcheck. If you go to soundcheck.org, there's a great video for this next song they're going to play for us. You should check it out. after they're done. The song is called Officer. Once again, here's St. Rich live on Soundcheck. That's the band St. Rich with a live performance of their song Officer here in the Soundcheck studio. Go to soundcheck.org to check out the video for that song, which is the lead-off track on their album Beyond the Drone. Once again, the members of St. Rich performing here in the studio. Now, Christian, there's a ring of truth to those lyrics. You know, was there really, like, a local cop who...
There was. Officer Gordon. Yeah.
And this is what, when you were in high school or something?
Yeah, he was kind of like the district officer, police officer from like when I was in first grade or something, you know.
Really?
And he was just
didn't like him?
Draconian. Yeah, stole my skateboard away all the time and he strip searched one of my friends in the woods.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the video, among the many things in the video, there are numerous shots of you skateboarding. So you still do that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Have you been watching, like, the slope style and the half pipe and all that stuff
no.
in the Olympics?
All I saw was the when they have rifles on skis.
Biathlon.
That's all I saw, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you guys are on tour, so you probably don't get a lot of time in front of the TV in the evenings.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I mean, for skateboarders, to see the snowboarding, does it even look like, you know... The same thing?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't know. Never got too into snowboarding.
Well, in New Jersey, you probably don't have a whole lot of opportunity to do it.
Right.
We do. We have a mountain.
You have a mountain.
We have one mountain.
You have one mountain.
It's a hot spot.
Yeah?
It's apparently people from New York City will come out there. Because we live out in rural New Jersey.
Do you still live there?
We're floaters.
Yeah.
So kind of.
Yeah. Steve is transitioning. I think.
I'm in a transitional period right now.
To what?
To New York City.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Spending more time here between tour.
Now, much of the video is shot here in New York. In fact, right across the street from our old studios on Center Street.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was kind of fun watching you. Now, so you really did this. You set up, and then what happened? Cops came.
Busted
us. Tore us down.
Yeah.
Were you actually playing, or were you sort of like miming to the recording?
It's hard to say.
Why is it hard to say? Or are you not allowed to say?
It's hard to say legally, yeah.
I see. Legally speaking,
what's going on there.
Okay. One final question for you guys. Beatles or Stones?
Yardbirds.
Stones.
Yardbirds,
yeah,
Steve.
I don't know.
Christian, you said Stones?
I said Stones.
Why?
I still haven't gotten too into the Beatles. I'm working my way in.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
50 years, man. They've been here, you know, 50-year anniversary.
I know.
Your chance to, like, do a deep dive into the Beatles.
I'm working on it.
All right. But the Stones, I'm a Stones man, too.
I'm a Beatles guy.
All right. Steve, Christian, thank you guys so much for bringing the band in. It's been great hearing you live in the Soundcheck studio.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You, but up next on the show, we're going to talk about smooth jazz. Nate Chenin of the New York Times joins us with the history of a once-proud radio format. And don't forget, for the next 3 weeks, the Soundcheck team is reading the autobiography from Morrissey, the former frontman of the Smiths. You can join our so-called Morrissey Book Club. Get the details at soundcheck.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. They called it smooth jazz, and if you turned on the radio in the late 80s or early 90s, it was hard to escape the sound of smooth jazz. By 2010 or so, those stations and the genre itself had pretty much disappeared from the airwaves. But reports of the death of smooth jazz, and you really have to say it that way, smooth jazz, have been greatly exaggerated. In fact, Nate Chenin, the jazz and pop critic of the New York Times, shared with us the evolution of this much maligned genre. He joined us back in July of 2013. I am surprised to find that there is still this kind of world out there and that it's apparently a pretty popular world.
Well, John, I'm so disappointed in you. I thought you had your ear to the ground, but apparently...
Thought I had my finger on the pulse. Is there a pulse to smooth
it jazz? It is a very slow resting pulse, yes. But, yeah, there is still a very vibrant, in fact, audience for smooth jazz. It's just that they're finding their fix in a different way than they used to.
Right. So here in New York, for many years, we had CD 101.9, and they actually would say smooth jazz.
Right.
You know? Where are they going to get their fix now?
Well, it's interesting. One of the former executives at CD 101.9 is now involved in this company that produces the Smooth Cruise. It's affiliated with Spirit Cruises, and it goes, you know, down the Hudson and up the East River. And that is where the sort of center of the action is now, if you are a smooth jazz fan.
How long has smooth jazz, I mean, sort of distinct from rough jazz? I mean, what do we call the rest of it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a kind of, there's a creation story to smooth jazz. And basically, it came out of a focus group. I believe it was in Chicago. They were testing out radio formats, uh-huh. and they had, you know, a focus group together and were playing some of this stuff. And a woman in the focus group said, yeah, you know, it's like jazz, but, you know, but not, I guess it's kind of like smooth jazz. And, you know, the bells went off in the control room behind the two-way mirror, you know. And that phrase, I think, was meant to, I mean, I can't get inside this woman's head, but I think it was meant to differentiate it from what we knew as jazz. And the difference was, number one, you know, there's not a lot of long solos. There's not a lot of rhythmic sort of disjunction. You know, it is about groove. It is about something kind of steady and smooth. And so it is kind of pop, really.
Right. Now, an early precursor to smooth jazz, you mentioned in the article, George Benson, the guitarist,
right.
who had a huge hit in the mid-70s with that album, Breezin'.
Yeah.
Is this, you know, sort of still considered part of that creation myth of smooth jazz?
Yeah, I mean, that predated the term.
Sure.
But, you know, these currents had been swirling around for a little while. And, you know, before George Benson did that, there was a series of records on the CTI label. Wes Montgomery, who, you know, many people consider the greatest or one of the greatest jazz guitarists mm-hmm. ever, he had a couple of albums that were produced with strings, and he was playing, like, Beatles songs and stuff. And a lot of jazz people just, you know, tore their hair out over this because, you know, this guy is wasting his talent, you know. Meanwhile, Wes Montgomery was probably able to buy himself, like, a nice house and a car with that, right? So the same thing happens with, you know, with Freddie Hubbard at that time, with George Benson.
Chuck Mangione.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, a lot of these guys, the first wave of smooth jazz, which wasn't even called that yet, the sort of proto-smooth mm-hmm. jazz, these were real, like, hardcore jazz musicians. I would put Grover Washington Jr. in that category,
yep.
too.
Yep.
They were real jazz musicians who had kind of figured out, you know what, I like reaching an audience. I like when people kind of groove, and I don't mind making some money, you know? And this was at a time when the market for jazz was really kind of iffy.
Yeah.
You know, the 70s
yeah.
were a very uncertain period for jazz artists. So, you know, all those things kind of converge, and then it becomes sort of commoditized and formatted, and then we get smooth jazz.
But in 1976, we just had guitarists like George Benson making a pile of money with songs like Breezin'.
Doctor, we'll see you now.
Now, that's George Benson with Breeze. And, I mean, this style of music, Nate Chenin of the New York Times with us, you know, it did sort of get associated with dentist offices and things like that. And then the radio format hit. And it became, I mean, it was big business. This was a hit record for George Benson in 76.
Yeah.
So smooth jazz becomes this thing. It becomes this marketing format that's really successful for a really long time.
You know, the 20 years ago, Kenny G had a top 40 hit, and it was his second such hit from the album Breathless, which at this point has sold more than 12 million copies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing that really prompted me to write this piece and delve into this world was the idea that, you know, what happened? Smooth jazz really was pop for a while. It was inescapable. As you said, you couldn't avoid it if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And today it still exists. It even thrives, but it's a subculture,
yeah,
you know? And so what happens when a music that is defined by its inescapability and its kind of, you know, pop sheen becomes, you know, an underground commodity somehow.
Or,
you know,
or a waterborne commodity, as is the case with these smooth cruises. So why did this happen? Why?
Well, you know, there's a pretty well-documented background that I didn't get into because the story has been out for a while, and it revolves around what happened with radio in 2008 and 2009. And it's amazing because it was this very kind of swift and devastating series of events. It has to do with Arbitron ratings. It has to do with Clear Channel and some decisions made at the corporate level.
Clear Channel owns like 200 radio stations around the country.
So all of a sudden, smooth jazz radio stations, and you know they're in almost every market, they convert virtually overnight into modern rock formats, into news radio, into sports radio. This decision is made to just flip the switch, and that happened with CD 101 here
in New York.
It became a modern rock station.
Very briefly,
and then
moving on to other formats. The surprise being that it was a moneymaker.
Mm-hmm.
And you point out in your article in the Times, this is an affluent audience. I mean, this is it may not be a huge audience, but man, it's golden.
Yeah. And, you know, but it's an older audience.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you talk about the desired advertiser demographic, and if they're wanting to chase after the kind of, you know, 18 to 35,
mm-hmm.
Which is always choice,
mm-hmm.
then smooth jazz is not what you're looking for. And it's, you know, so basically it was that kind of marketing decision that led the way.
All right. So in the last few years then, we've heard less and less of it on the radio, and it sort of moved, as you say, to these cruises, some of which the one you went on is just like a day trip, right?
It's just basically a sunset cruise. It was only 2 hours.
Okay. But some of them can be like over to the Mediterranean and back.
Week long, yeah. Yeah. So the smooth jazz cruise, which I think was started in 2004, that, I mean, the 2014 edition is sold out. It's been sold out for months.
Wow.
Dave Koz has one, you know, and these are very, very big. And if you look at the lineup, very sort of star-studded events.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to define your terms big and star in this field. I mean, Dave Koz, is he a big star in the world of smooth jazz?
He is. He's a name brand. He released his first album in 1990, and that was kind of peak smooth jazz.
Uh-huh.
He's had a couple of gold records. And since it was released, his new album, Summer Horns, has been on the jazz chart, the Billboard Jazz Chart, and the Smooth Jazz Songs Chart. And, you know,
But what are we talking about, the smooth jazz? I mean, are we talking about million sellers?
No.
100 albums sold?
At this point, you know, as everyone knows, the scale of sales in the record business is quite a different thing.
Yeah.
I think I last checked after the album had been out for 2 weeks, and it had sold just under 10,000 copies,
mm-hmm. Okay.
Which was good enough for, you know, number three, I think, on the jazz albums chart behind Michael Bublé and Harry Connick Jr.
Mm-hmm. little bit of music from Dave Koz. The album is called Summer Horns. And we're talking with Nate Chenin, journalist at the New York Times, who writes about jazz and pop music for them. And his article called Smooth Sailing in a Sea of Evolution, Smooth Jazz Finds New Ways to Reach Its Audience, is linked on our website, soundcheck.org. All right, so your article is not just about the fact that smooth jazz still exists and now is out at sea, but also that it has kind of evolved. And it seems like playing covers, you know, really making explicit that old connection to pop music as opposed to jazz is part of this recent evolution.
Yeah, well, that has been there from the beginning. We mentioned those Wes Montgomery records.
Right.
It's definitely it's a big thing. And that's kind of, you know, the sort of what used to be called elevator music, easy listening, you know, taking a song that we know and rendering it kind of pablum.
Mm-hmm.
so that's still around. And, you know, Dave Koz does it on his new record. This group BWB, whom I saw on the Smooth Cruise, they do it with Michael Jackson. But the best of these smooth jazz artists are also really suave melodists, and they know how to write a song that kind of lodges, you know, in your head. This guy Boney James, who was very successful this spring with his release, The Beat. He's really good at writing a pop, like a catchy instrumental pop tune. And Koz, at his best, is also good at that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that George Benson song, Breezin', from 1976, I mean, that's an earworm.
Total earworm.
Do these guys use, and they do seem to mostly be guys, do they use the term smooth jazz to describe what they do?
Most of the people I've spoken to don't like it, but are ultimately okay with it because it's kind of, you know, there's no point in fighting it. And they certainly don't balk at appearing under the banner of smooth jazz, you know, on all of these cruises and, you know, concert series at wineries and things like that.
And it almost sounds like a joke, but the Weather Channel released an album of smooth jazz kind of classics, what, about 5 or 6 years ago?
It was 2008 was the 2007, I think, was the first one. 2008 was the second one. And
so successful they had to do a follow-up.
Right.
The Weather Channel.
Oh, yeah.
Presenting smooth jazz. So one of the other things I wanted to ask you about your article before we wrap up here, one of the guys, it might be Dave Koz, sort of points to the new Daft Punk record and says, hey, that's some of our sound there.
Right, right.
What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thought because we all sort of assume that smooth jazz is this sort of fake or debased or kind of, you know, light offering that that doesn't have anything to do with real music. But if you are a fan of smooth jazz or one of its practitioners, you know, you look at pop music today and you see a bunch of stuff that was produced, you know, in a room with synthesizers or on a computer, and there's no real musicianship involved and everyone's auto-tuned, you know. And so to their credit, these are real musicians. Most of these artists, they use maybe some drum programming, but they also, they have real drummers, they have real, you know, rhythm sections. They're playing music, you know? And so from their perspective, like, hey, this is the real stuff. And you look at the Daft Punk record, it's the same ethos. It's this idea of let's get some really great studio musicians. I just got, Toto is going back out on tour soon for the first time in almost a decade.
Wow.
Toto, the guys in Toto were the guys on, you know, Off the Wall and Beat It. You know,
they were great studio players.
Exactly.
I hear the drums echoing tonight, and she hears only whispers of some quiet conversation.
You know, there is something swirling around now. I mean, Justin Vernon of Bon Iver, you listen to some of what he does. You can't tell me that that's not kind of adjacent to smooth jazz.
And the kind of resurrection of interest in AM 1970s radio,
sure,
which could be very kind of easy listening. Yeah. All right, so there's a lot going on, but at least one thing that is going on is some smooth sailing, out there on the oceans and up and down the Hudson River. You can read Nate Chenin's article on smooth jazz and the smooth cruise on our website at soundcheck.org. And Nate, always a pleasure to see you.
My pleasure, John. Thanks.
On the show, Ray Davies of the Kinks is set to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Music writer Joe Levy will join us for something we're calling the Soundcheck Guide to the Kinks. Plus live music from the orchestral pop ensemble Lost in the Trees. And what your Pandora station can tell us about your politics. That's tomorrow on Soundcheck. Our program's a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, Mike Katziff, and Amy Pearl. Our theme is by Marco Benevento. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.